Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of April. This hour, the United States v. Texas. One of our guests says it's the biggest immigration case in a century, and it is explained in an article in Vox. The article goes like this: when it takes up the question of whether President Obama's 2014 immigration executive actions were constitutional, the Supreme Court will throw out its typical playbook. It's one of the most, if not the most important cases before the highest court this term, and certainly the most important immigration case the Supreme Court has taken up in a generation, or arguably in a century, and the court is treating it accordingly. Another guest says there are five key questions from the arguments. The court's conservatives seem content with a 4-4 tie, but Justice Elena Kagan worked hard on Monday of this week to undermine the case against President Obama's executive actions. So we'll talk about the case and its importance and the rulings and how many points of law are being discussed here and who gave oral arguments. We have two guests with us this hour. Sam Baker, staff correspondent at National Journal, mostly writes about the Supreme Court and legal affairs. Sam, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and Dara Lind is also here, who covers immigration and the justice system for Vox. Dara, thank you so much for being with us. Oh, we got you on another line. I'm sorry. Hi, Dara.
Hi, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us.
No worries, thank you.
You have called this just a very, very big, big case. As a matter of fact, you said that it could be one of the most important cases the Supreme Court has handled in a century when it comes to immigration. Why is it so large?
So part of this is because the way immigration law works in America is different from kind of the balance of powers for other areas of law. One of the main arguments that the Obama administration is using in this case, and that really even the states that are challenging President Obama's executive actions of 2014 more or less agree on, is that when it comes to immigration, the executive branch has a lot of power and a lot of leeway to choose where resources are going and what the priorities are in terms of enforcing immigration law. So the Supreme Court hasn't been as active in kind of deciding the limits of executive power in that regard as it has been in a lot of other cases. And because the federal government has so much power over immigration, there aren't as many questions about federal versus state. But in this case, the states are challenging that the Obama administration has kind of gotten into the zone that is Congress's to regulate when it comes to, actually allowing millions of people to work in the U.S. legally for a temporary, for a couple of years at a time. And it's a question, again, of federal versus state power, not just in immigration, but in other areas, because the states have brought a challenge of a federal policy, either because it actually brings a cost to them, which is their argument, or just because they don't like it, which is the federal government.
Mm-hmm. We're going to try and get you on a better phone line. We're going to go with Sam for a little while here because it's a little scratchy and what you say is important. We want to make sure to hear it. Sam, you wrote there didn't appear on Monday to be five votes for anything, not for a decision dismissing the case or a victory on either side or even the narrower rulings. Why do you say that?
That's all it takes now to win is five votes, or that's all it's ever taken. But the court seemed very evenly split. Going into the arguments, there was a lot of thought on the left that maybe Chief Justice Roberts' vote was gettable for the Obama administration on this issue of standing. That is, whether these states even have the right to bring this suit, irrespective of whether they're right. He didn't seem to take that bait. Justice Kennedy seemed, maybe a little bit more on the fence, but generally seemed to side more with his conservative colleagues. And none of the liberal justices seemed like they were inclined to rule against the administration no one seemed to kind of look for an off-ramp or a way that they could make this easy. They just kind of got right into the most divisive issues, and nobody budged. So it's not clear how they could avoid a tie here, or I should say it's not clear whether they really want to avoid a tie here.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at whether or not it's even legal for Texas to sue the federal government. It's my understanding that this is over the cost to Texas of driver's licenses. Is that right?
That is right. Yes. When people are allowed to work in the United States, even though they're not citizens. They're eligible in Texas and in most other states for a driver's license, just sort of as part of the normal background check process. And Texas says, look, you're allowing all these people to remain in the country who are here illegally. They would be eligible for work authorizations under President Obama's executive actions. And therefore, it's going to cost us a boatload of money to print driver's licenses for them. And the Justice Department came in and said, look, that's not a real injury. This, you choose to provide driver's licenses to people, and you choose to subsidize the cost of those licenses. So you can't come into court and say, well, the federal government has made some change in policy, and it's going to cost me money. That's just really not enough of a harm for a state to bring this case. But again, there didn't seem to be five votes to agree with the Justice Department's position there during the oral argument.
And can you always tell, or are there justices who seem to be arguing a side that they don't necessarily agree with? They're just trying to be tough questioners.
That is certainly something that they do. You know, a lot of times in oral arguments, they will hit one point really hard because they agree with it, and just to sort of try to tease out what are the limits of it, or what am I getting myself into if I, you know, say this in a decision. But there are sort of ways to differentiate. You know, Chief Justice Roberts was again who people were looking at here on standing, and I think it was noteworthy. He had some really aggressive questions that sort of seemed to presuppose that that the states do have standing, that the government is wrong. He asked all those questions of the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, who was representing the U.S., and then he didn't really raise the issue at all when he was questioning Texas's lawyer, which is sort of a sign that maybe he's not just trying to, you know, tease out all the implications of this issue, but that really maybe was where he was leaning.
Mm-hmm. And give us an understanding, a more complete understanding of what executive authority President Obama has used in this area.
Right. You know, the sort of factual question there is actually just as important here as the legal question. These are there were two orders that President Obama announced in 2014, one that allowed children who were born in the United States to stay in the United States even if they were not here legally. And then the one that's at issue in the, before the Supreme Court allowed parents of those children, if they meet certain other criteria, to... It's called deferred action, basically meaning the Homeland Security Department is not going to put its deportation resources, because they can only deport so many people each year, that they're not going to focus on these people. That is an area where there's a pretty broad consensus that it's true. There's only so much money to be spent on deportations. It's been the case in the past that administrations have been able to sort of decide how they want to allocate that money. But then Texas says, look, this particular order has gone further. Because people are eligible to work, you're imposing these new costs on the states. So there is sort of a debate about, is this just enforcement discretion, or is this sort of granting people lawful presence inside the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. And Sam, why wasn't there a big uproar about 2012, that executive order? That wasn't challenged, was it?
It wasn't. I guess maybe just because children aren't eligible for driver's licenses. I mean, that still was controversial, but no, that's not. Texas has not challenged that here.
Yeah. And also give us an idea of the number of deportations. I've read that the president did use have a number of deportations early on in his presidency. Did he change his mind on this issue? Was he doing it willingly in the early years of his presidency, or was forced to by the law, or what?
No, I don't think it was necessarily that he changed his mind. I think, you know, you even saw Texas's lawyer concede during the oral arguments that, you know, or he didn't come in and try to say, you know, this administration's been lax on deportation in general. I think they all sort of stipulate that the Obama administration has been aggressive on deportations. It has
right.
Deported more people, certainly, than we've seen in a very long time. But they can't even scratch the surface in terms of deporting everyone who's here illegally.
Mm-hmm. This phrase it has been so much a part of your reporting and many others reporting. The phrase lawful presence being thrown a lot, around a bit on Monday. What does lawful presence mean?
there are many flavors of lawful presence and legal presence and all of the sort of permutations of that term. There are a lot of ways, even before this, before DAPA, before the action that's being challenged here, for people who are in the country on sort of a temporary basis to gain the right to work. And Texas is sort of saying, look, you're giving now the people who are eligible for DAPA not just the right to work, but the right to, you're sort of saying that it's okay that they're in the country, they're becoming eligible for certain benefits, mostly Social Security, because if you're working, you're paying into Social Security, so the argument goes you can then receive it on the back end. And the administration maybe unwisely used that term. I forget if they said lawful presence or legal presence, but one of those in the memorandum that's being challenged here. That is not the same thing as deferred action, which is just sort of, we know you're here, it's against the law, but we're going to tolerate it because you're not our high priority.
Mm-hmm.
So there was actually, this came up on Monday, Don Verrilli, who was representing the Obama administration, said, look, if you guys want to just strike out those words from the memorandum, that's fine. That's great. And, you know, so the question is, if they do that, does that really achieve what Texas is looking for here or not?
Yeah. We're going to try Dara again. Dara, we read that the president has quite a bit of authority when it comes to immigration in this country. Is there a clear line between what the president can do and what is in the purview of Congress?
Neither side has really established a clear line. Texas and the states haven't, you know, during oral argument, kind of gave a few different reasons why something else, something smaller that the president might have done, you know, giving work authorization to fewer people or just giving it to people one by one instead of kind of sending out a call for applications would have been constitutional, but what he did wasn't, but never really had a single argument. The Obama administration, on the other hand, has argued that they don't feel it would be illegal for them to just allow all 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the country to, you know, get protection from deportation and work permits. But that's based on their own legal opinions. It's based on their own kind of assessment of what would be too far for them to go. They haven't really pointed to a bright line in the law. So that's really a problem for both sides, I think, especially for Justice Kennedy, who is generally very concerned about the notion that there should be limiting principles in granting power to the executive or to the federal government. On the other hand, without Texas and the states being able to argue that there's a clear line of congressional authority that's been crossed already, and with, you know, a history of presidents granting groups of immigrants that, you know, the chance to apply for deferred action, they can't exactly say that it should have been obvious that this time around the executive got it wrong, especially when there wasn't a serious legal challenge when the president allowed some 700,000 young unauthorized immigrants to apply for deferred action back in 2012.
Mm. What does it mean? And let's start with you, Dara, on this, and then we'll go to you, Sam. What does it mean that all of this is taking place right smack dab in the middle of a major presidential election on an issue that has been much discussed by both sides?
So, for one thing, it's possible to speculate that if it hadn't been, you know, in the middle of a presidential election, if it hadn't been the second term of a president who was very, you know, unpopular with the Republican base, at least, that this lawsuit wouldn't have been brought at all. You know, you could arguably point to the 2012 action again and say, well, what's different this time? What was different was that it was after a midterm election in which the president, you know, the president's party lost several seats. But certainly now that it's happening in the middle of an election cycle, at the moment, one in which not only immigration, but the Supreme Court itself has become a major issue. And, of
right.
course, the reason that we're even talking about an 8-8 tie, or a 4-4 tie as a possibility, is because of Senate Republicans' refusal to, you know, confirm Merrick Garland. Because of all of that, there's probably a little more pressure on the court, even than there would otherwise be, to present itself as above partisan politics.
Right.
No, it's something
right.
that, you know, that Chief Justice Roberts is very concerned about. So it just might be kind of an extra layer on top of all of that. The other thing, however, is that once a new president is elected in November, if that's a Republican president, regardless of what the Supreme Court decides now, the deferred action program is probably going to be ended. The only question is whether people would be, you know, first on the list for deportation or whether they would just kind of have their current protections revoked. Likewise, if there's a Democratic president, regardless of what the court decides now, it's likely that a president, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, would find some way to say that they can, you know, issue more protections and more work permits and just kind of force another case to go through the courts if Republican governors wanted to challenge that too.
Mm. And Sam, put politics in the mix. What's your analysis?
I think, you know, it's not just November. This decision will probably come down at the end of June. We're talking about just a couple of weeks before the Republican convention, mm-hmm. where they probably won't have a nominee yet. I think it's pretty easy to see how any ruling in favor of the Obama administration would rile up sort of the Donald Trump base that cares a lot about immigration. That's one of their big issues. It's his biggest issue, obviously. At the same time, you know, I think it's true that that's a situation, however it plays, with anybody's base that John Roberts doesn't like to be in, that he doesn't want to be in. He was in that in the last presidential election year with the big Obamacare ruling. And that's why I think a lot of people were going into Monday's arguments sort of expecting him to be looking for a way out, and he didn't really seem to be. That was one of the most surprising things about this. So if there is going to be a way for them to try to stay out of the political fire, I think it's something that they're going to have to talk about themselves privately, and not something that came up Monday.
Yeah. You also, Dara, wrote about how unusual it was, a 90-minute oral argument, and it's usually 30-30 one side the other. But Monday was different. Why was it different, and how was it different?
Occasionally in major cases, in cases where there are a lot of different questions being considered, they will go to 90 minutes so that they can cover all the aspects. So, you know, in this case, given how much time they spent on the question of whether Texas even had standing, it made some sense that they would want to split that up. But the less usual thing is that instead of just having the administration argue its side and the states argue theirs, Congress, the House of Representatives, had submitted a brief asking to give an argument alongside the states that the president's actions were illegal and unconstitutional, and got 15 minutes to do that, mostly, you know, arguing this wasn't what we meant when we passed the laws, which is an interesting argument to make, but given that, you know, the court was so fixated on the standing question, it wasn't, you know, the House wasn't necessarily an authority there. It was coming in, if not in a partisan manner, certainly an ideological one. The other interesting move was that the Supreme Court actually granted 10 minutes to a lawyer representing a group of unauthorized immigrant women in Texas who would be able to apply for deferred action if the president's plan had gone forward. This was kind of, you know, when it was announced before the oral decision, treated as, you know, the court thinking of the equities of immigrants as part of this case and thinking about the effect on real people. It wasn't that at all. It was, you know, mostly a very technical argument about whether Texas had standing and what civil rights groups would do if Texas tried to change its laws on its own right. But it was an interesting echo because it's still, the lawyer was only there on behalf of a group of people who couldn't actually speak before the court, but who would be feeling the effects of this decision. So it was a very weird time to be in the courtroom, and a very, outside the courtroom on Monday, there was a tremendous demonstration, a lot of immigrant activists. And, you know, for anyone who had had to walk through that on the way in, it was a very strong reminder of kind of the people who feel that their lives are at stake in this case.
Right. Elena Kagan, you have written that Elena Kagan, if DAPA lives, Elena Kagan will likely deserve the credit for its survival. Why do you write that?
It goes back to an exchange, actually, that she had with the attorney representing House Republicans. She really pressed the case during Monday's argument, pressing that attorney and also Texas's attorney, you know, all right, what if it was a smaller group? What if it was people who are over the age of 50, who've been in the country for 30 years, you know, really trying to sort of tease out much narrower forms of enforcement discretion that a president could hypothetically offer? And she kept getting the answer, no, president couldn't do that. No, a president couldn't do that. No, a president couldn't do that. So, you know, I think Kagan sort of did most of the work among the liberal justices at trying to put the conservative attorneys sort of in a box where they were saying, you know, maybe going a little farther than they would have preferred to in terms of the constraints they would place on the executive's power.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking this hour about the oral arguments that the U.S. Supreme Court heard on Monday of this week concerning President Barack Obama's November 2014 executive action on immigration. Our guests would agree it's a very important immigration case, one of the most important in the century, and it's happening right in the middle of a presidential election and a Supreme Court that doesn't have all of its members. It could conceivably land in a 4-4 tie. And then what does that mean? Or if it goes the other way, if it goes in favor of the administration, what does that mean? And if it goes in favor of the state's challenge, what does that mean? Because the outcomes are extremely interesting. We're going to welcome phone calls for both of our guests. And our guests are Dara Lind, who covers immigration and the justice system for Vox, and Sam Baker, staff correspondent at National Journal, who writes mostly about the U.S. Supreme Court and legal affairs. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to hear your thoughts about immigration. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. It's interesting. There are lots of different areas in this ruling, but essentially it's looking at this deferred action program for parents of Americans, allowing millions of unauthorized immigrants who have U.S. citizen or permanent resident children to apply for deportation protection and work permits as well. Essentially, Texas and the other states who have joined suit here, 25 states, say that it's a burden on the state because they would have to pay for driver's licenses. The administration is saying no. It also looks at a lot of other areas of law in this question that has been discussed frequently, whether or not the president of the United States, what his authority is in immigration matters. That's just it in a nutshell. We're going beyond that. But welcome to your thoughts about this. What do you think about this happening in a presidential year? What do you think about the deferred action program? And we can also just speculate as to which way you think the court will rule on this issue, with a ruling coming down right before the Republican convention, ruling expected in late June. Our phone number, we'd love to hear from you, 800-486-8655. We're welcoming phone calls now on the Supreme Court taking up perhaps one of the most, if not the most important case before the highest court this term. Certainly, as one of our guests has written, the most important immigration case the Supreme Court has taken up in a generation or arguably a century. And we have looked at what the issues are here and what the implications will be between for relationships between Congress and the president, the relationship between the federal government and the states, the presidential election year, when immigration, of course, has become an issue here. And it's interesting how the court may decide here and what the ramifications would be. So what do you think? We welcome your phone calls at 800-486-8655. And start our calls with Jean in Madison. Hi, Jean.
Hi. So I'm wondering if whatever changes happen, would the persons here illegally still be able to apply for the tax credit on their taxes if they have a small business, however that is, and still be able to claim all the children that they have, nephews and nieces in Mexico, et cetera? Will they still be able to claim all those children and
okay, what are the tax implications, Dara?
Sure. So when people who are here working illegally but paying taxes, file those taxes, they do currently receive, as you mentioned, the child tax credit for children who are, here as citizens, permanent residents. Those are, people who would be getting that tax credit. Many of them are the people who would be eligible for this program. But the program doesn't touch tax or most benefits directly. One of the things that the states are saying about why this action by the Obama administration goes too far is that it would open people up to be eligible for Social Security in the future, or rather to be putting money into Social Security now so that they'd be able to take it out later. That's one of the problems that they have with, allowing them to stay in the country and work legally. But as far as tax implications, whether or not they're working legally, if they're paying taxes but working illegally, then yes, the child tax credit would still apply. That's something that Congress has tried to address a few times over the years, but hasn't quite gotten majorities in both houses to actually change that law.
Sam, I wanted to ask a question. It's not just Texas. It's United States versus Texas, but there are 25 other states who are suing here as well. Does that mean all 25 of those states also feel it's a burden to be providing driver's licenses?
Legally, the rule is that if one of the parties has standing, they all have standing.
I see.
So Texas is the only one who needs to prove that case. None of the other ones are free to ride along.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Marty in Burlington. Hi, Marty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of things. I've heard in recent cases where judges make the defense and the prosecutor, whatever, go back into the back room, and you guys don't come out until you come up with something. Why can't we do this with the Supreme Court? And I'm obviously showing my lack of legal intelligence. The second thing is, if the whole issue is, the cost that it's going to be to create these new driver's licenses, why don't the Democrats just pick up the tab? Wouldn't we benefit the supposed additional tax revenue from these workers? And I'll listen to your answer off air.
Thanks, Marie. Dara.
Sure. As far as the cost of driver's licenses is concerned, what's interesting here is that Texas isn't arguing that it would end up paying more for driver's licenses than it would collect from people in new taxes, in other revenue. It's just arguing that because it would have to pay out that one cost, that's enough reason for them to be able to sue the federal government. The federal government is arguing that on net, the state of Texas would actually make money because people would be able to earn more by working, having their wages above ground, having to pay in fully for payroll taxes, et cetera. So, and Texas, while it's pretty clear that they disagree with that in theory, hasn't even needed to contest that. It's just about the driver's license cost is a legal question as much as, if not more than, an economic one.
Interesting. Did you feel that it was a stretch, both of you, for the states and for Texas to come up with driver's license costs as one of the major issues in this case? Was that a stretch? Were there other areas that they could have gone to?
It's certainly, I could understand why that assertion to get standing was so controversial and why everyone thought there was such a good, I can understand why the court spent a lot of time on it. Whether it's a stretch or not, the justices will decide, but it is not rock solid, I'll say that.
Mm-hmm. Dara, what do you say?
I think that it's a good example of just how much narrower this case is than the debate around it. I think it's pretty clear that most of the people who think that Texas and the states have the right side of this case think that unauthorized immigrants cause harm to state governments, cause harm to society for all sorts of reasons. But what they can actually quantify and get legal standing on is just this very narrow question of driver's licenses. Initially, the states were trying to present all of these, people, they suck up benefits and they cost us money in crime and that kind of thing. And it's just been narrowed to, what at least both sides can agree is a cost the state would have to pay.
Let's go to Greg next in Glidden. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, guests. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Oh, just fine.
Good.
Now, I can't understand about the immigration thing that the Republican Party is trying to dissuade all those immigrants. And I can't understand why Texas seems to have a very poor argument. By legal standards, they have a very poor argument about driver's licenses, prices, and all that stuff.
Do you think it's a poor argument, Sam?
I think, you know, I think on standing there is, they are maybe stretching somewhat, but you know, this was obviously a controversial action when Obama took it, and it was sort of one of those things. Obamacare was one, the Clean Power Plan was one, this was one where we just sort of all figured, all right, this is going to be settled by the Supreme Court. You know, there might have been some opportunities if this had been filed by a different state in a different lower court where maybe it would have been thrown out on standing earlier. That probably would have been appealed to the Supreme Court. So I don't think it's surprising that we are where we are. But, you know, I think standing is an issue for Texas, or at least it seemed like that in theory before Monday. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about what happens here, because there's some really interesting possibilities if it's tied, or if it's 5-4 in favor of the administration or 5-4 in favor of Texas and the other states. The outcome is pretty interesting in some of those scenarios, isn't it, Dara?
Yes. So it's certainly in the case of a 4-4 split, we'll start with that, because it is pretty unlikely, given oral arguments, that one of the liberal justices is going to suddenly decide that the Obama administration has been wrong all this time. So in the case of a 4-4 split, the lower court decision holds, which means that the deferred action programs stay on hold permanently. However, because that was only a circuit court decision, it wasn't a Supreme Court decision, and just because the Supreme Court splits on it doesn't create a precedent at that level, it opens the possibility up for immigration advocates to file a countersuit somewhere else to try to argue that it hurts, say, the state of California not to have deferred action in place, and then try to get that up to the, you know, to a more favorable liberal court that has been very favorable to the administration on this issue before, try to get a circuit split, which would put the Supreme Court in the extremely awkward position of having to, you know, litigate where an injunction might be in place or not in place when it's just tried to punt this case, you know, hopefully to the next president.
Oh, interesting. So if you go back and other circuit courts rule differently, can it go back to the Supreme Court? Does it have to go back to the Supreme Court after they've already heard this?
Absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't be this particular case. Theoretically, it would be the case kind of coming out of the, you know, Ninth Circuit or wherever. It's been assumed that in some of the other cases that have had 4-4 splits, say the California Teachers Union case that was split last month, I believe, it's been assumed that a similar case is going to come up before the court sometime in the next few years, because it's a hot issue and there are a lot of suits along those lines. Mm-hmm. The reason that that hasn't been assumed for the immigration case is because, again, this situation will probably be totally different a year from now. The next president is almost certainly, you know, unless the Supreme Court does uphold these programs outright and allow them to go forward, and a Democratic president is elected, we're probably going to have a very different situation with immigration under the next president. So it's probably not going to be worthwhile to kind of keep a dead letter case alive in the court.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I'm wondering about the sensitivity, if you sense any sensitivity. I know they're supposed to be above public sentiment on this, but it's hard to be not aware of that, particularly when you're very close to a convention, major party conventions here. Is there any sense of where the public is on this issue? Because it would appear to me that most people are in favor of, you know, some kind of access, some pathway to citizenship. Is that involved in any way at all in this case or not, Sam?
No, not really. You know, the court tries to leave those sort of considerations out of it as best as it can. You know, the key words there being as best as it can. That's, you know, it's certainly something that is probably on their minds, in the back of their mind, but so far they've focused really pretty narrowly on the legal questions here and on the questions about the president's authority. To the extent that it is that the sort of external political situation does weigh on them, I do think that it would be to sort of make them think it's not so bad to leave this for the next president. You know, like, we can stay out of this for now, and if Hillary Clinton wins, she can do her own thing in some similar way or slightly different, and we'll decide that rather than, you know, wading into this right now. Hmm. But I think that's sort of the extent of their political involvement.
Yeah. So if that's the case, why didn't they just hold off on hearing this case until the next president was elected? Tara?
Bear in mind that they did grant this case for a hearing before the death of Justice Scalia, so before the fear of a four-court split was really an option. And I think that that's very important here. They, at the time, were assuming that they were going to be able to either, you know, rule for sure that the states were in the right and take what had been a relatively narrow decision by the Fifth Circuit and turn it into a broader decision that kind of incorporated some constitutional questions that the Fifth Circuit hadn't considered, or they would reverse the Fifth Circuit's decision and say that it was, you know, that the program should go forward, which would obviously be, you know, a good reason for them to have taken the case to actually, you know, settle the question and tell the lower courts, you know, that it was wrong. So at the time, they kind of didn't have the downside, and I wouldn't say that there's downside to them taking the decision, but the option that they could vote on the case and still not resolve it wasn't really an issue until the death of Justice Scalia and the subsequent, you know, it becoming apparent that that spot was not going to get filled.
Mm-hmm. Sam, you were looking at Justice Kagan. A lot of attention is always paid to Justice Kennedy, who's been a swing vote in many important cases. What sense did you have where he was going with this during questioning?
To be broadly sort of on the right, but he did seem open to one of the sort of narrower arguments on the right, which is that the administration, you know, maybe DAPA is okay, but the administration did it wrong. That they just went about it in the wrong way. This was issued just as a guidance. It's not even a regulation. And one of the claims that Texas has made was it should have been a regulation where the states would have the opportunity to file formal comments and it would have to sort of go through this long process. Regulations are on a little bit firmer ground legally. They're just sort of a more substantive type of rulemaking. He asked a couple of times whether maybe Texas should have filed a suit that would have focused more sort of on that aspect of the case rather than where they did focus their attention. So, I think if a vote is gettable for the liberals, it's probably him and not Chief Justice Roberts. And that, you know, he was sort of hard to read, but he did seem pretty skeptical of the Obama administration's use of executive authority here. So I would expect some kind of ruling from him, probably against the administration.
Mm. It must be hard to be in the business of having to read these people, right? Are you looking at their faces, too? And how do you do that?
It's very difficult, and it's totally an inexact science. And as we said earlier, oral arguments can only tell you so much, but they do give you a sense of what they teach you the most is how the justices are thinking about the core questions, how they phrase their questions, what they ask them most, kind of tells you the framework in which they're seeing it. And Justice Kennedy asked a lot of questions about, well, shouldn't Congress be doing this first and not the administration? He just sort of honed in on it in a way that, you know, you can overread into oral arguments and try to predict, well, here's what everyone will say, you know, verbatim.
Right.
But I do think you can get a sense of skepticism from
them. Mm-hmm. And Dara, what are the real life consequences for all of the people who will be affected by this in Texas and in other states?
Sure. So over the last couple of years, the Obama administration really has made an effort to avoid deporting people who have been here for a long time, who are settled, who have families, who haven't committed crimes. That said, the risk of deportation is always there, and some field agents in particular feel that they're kind of being held back and that they should be able to deport people, you know, regardless of how long they've been in the country if they don't have papers. So there's a lot of fear hanging over people in addition to just not being able to work legally, not being able to leave the country and return. People will say that their parents or grandparents have died or are very sick in their home countries, but they can't go see them because they know that if they come back to the U.S., they'll be stopped at the border and kept from getting in. All of those are things that, you know, the people who have received the 2012 deferred action now can do. And there have been, you know, several studies showing that those who work have gotten better paying jobs. many of them have gone back to school, gotten higher degrees, you know, gotten into jobs that they see as their careers. It's still not as much a benefit as, you know, becoming a legal immigrant or becoming a citizen would. There's still a certain reluctance, especially among employers, to hire people who might not be able to work for you legally in a year or two's time, or to not, you know, invest resources in developing those people, certainly. But it's a huge difference from not only not being able to practically work legally, but kind of feeling isolated and feeling worried that if you, you know, stick your head up, if you do anything, you know, impressive or excellent, that you're just calling attention to yourself and asking for deportation. Mm.
And those success stories, did they find their way to the Supreme Court oral arguments, or were they not really a part of the whole discussion?
The Supreme Court is extremely good at ignoring kind of human story level issues, at least when they're, at least in the text of cases. Many of these got filed as briefs by advocacy groups, you know, kind of in the run-up to oral arguments. And you can absolutely imagine that especially some of the more liberal justices on the court, you know, especially Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who has actually been, you know, vocally advocating for the court to change the way that it refers to unauthorized immigrants and not to call them illegal immigrants, you can certainly imagine them being kind of, you know, emotionally moved and sympathetic. But the court, as a, in general, as a rule, at least tries to present itself as being swayed only by the facts of the law and not allowing sentiment to sway their decisions in either way. Mm-hmm. The question, of course, is always whether that, whether someone can be completely objective, but that's much bigger than this case alone. Mm.
Did you see any of that sentiment, Sam, in the courtroom?
No, no, I think Dara's right. They just kept it to the law and the facts here.
Mm-hmm. We are going to pause for a moment and welcome more phone calls. We're looking at the Supreme Court having oral arguments on President Barack Obama's November of 2014 executive action on immigration. And it's a very, very important case. It will be decided. There are a couple different areas of law here, but we're looking at what the oral arguments that were heard, how the court is likely to go, what the ramifications are in terms of parents, particularly of those who have children who are here, who are American citizens. And they, as a result of 2012 executive order, were allowed to come to the U.S. as children to apply for temporary protection from deportation and work permits. Now we're looking at this new deferred action program for parents of Americans, which has allowed millions of unauthorized immigrants who have U.S. citizen or permanent resident children to apply for deportation protection and work permits as well. And we're looking at what the case involves, who testified, where the court is likely to go. And welcoming your phone calls on this, too. And if you may want to talk about the political nature of this, that all this happens in an election year. So who does it benefit if the court rules in favor of Texas? Who does it benefit politically, if anybody, if they rule in favor of the president's executive actions? What are the political ramifications for this? What are the humanitarian ramifications of this? What are the legal ramifications of this? We welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. All right, let's go to more phone calls. Pauline is next in Evanston. Hi, Pauline.
Hi. So I'm a child of immigrants. I'm a first-generation American. You know, however, my parents came here through proper channels, and I guess I'm concerned that people who didn't come through the proper channels are being rewarded, and I'm concerned about the precedent that's and the message that it sends with these potential actions.
Sam, you want to respond?
I think that's something that you hear a lot in the sort of broader political debate that surrounds this case and surrounds immigration generally. You know, you hear that argument, and then you hear that contrasted with there's 11 million people already here, you know, have come here for a better life and to work hard and pay taxes. And you're not going to deport all of them. So, you know, we might as well create a process that's gonna work for the people who are already here. So that's definitely what you hear playing out. I think that's what you're going to hear play out in the fall. You know, is this issue take center stage in the presidential race? And that's not directly one of the questions before the Supreme Court, but whatever they say will obviously play into that broader political debate.
Dara, you want to respond?
Sure. I think that one of the things that people don't often understand about immigration history is that it actually, until about 20 years ago, was a lot easier, even if you'd come to the country illegally. If you'd been here for a certain amount of time, especially if you had kids who were U.S. citizens, there was a process that was difficult but not impossible to go through to adjust your status. That hasn't been the case for about 20 years because of a law passed, actually signed by President Clinton in 96. And so when you look at the population that's currently here, the majority of unauthorized immigrants have been here over a decade. You know, millions of them have different kids. Part of the reason that that's so unprecedented is because this is the first time in, you know, modern immigration history where those people didn't have a way to get legal. So I think that it's important to kind of see it in terms of what the, you know, how not just the laws rewarding people versus not, but, you know, what the options have been kind of have influenced the size of the, you know, we have 11 million people here population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Pauline. Mark and Barron, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a simple question. It just occurs to me, with illegal immigration, why not just make it easier? Give people who want to come to the country an ID card, just like a credit card, and make it easier for them to get here. That way we can identify, collect taxes, they can pay whatever. That eliminates the illegal workers. It's a simplistic question, but why not do it that way?
Sam?
There is a pretty big political consensus to do exactly that, to make it easier. I think you saw President Obama really, you know, put a fair amount of weight behind comprehensive immigration reform. It is the pathway to citizenship for people who are already here that torpedoed that bill. But I think, you know, if you see a Democratic president elected in the fall, I think you'll see a very similar push to do exactly that over the next 8 years or however long it takes.
Maybe we'll see nothing done, because this sure is a contentious issue. We just don't seem to be able to do much of anything.
That's true. And I think that's one of the reasons that this particular case is so important, is it's going to kind of help set the bounds of if it still remains impossible to do something in Congress. And that's the backdrop against which Obama announced these actions. This case is going to kind of help define, all right, how much can a president do on their own?
Yeah. About a minute left. We go to Jim in Wisconsin. Hi, Jim.
Hi. My comment is, the president has overstepped his bounds. And he took an action that president has never, ever done before in history. And he usurped the power of the Congress and of the American people, because just like the IRS just had a bunch of laws, change in laws pending, and there had to be a period of the American people advise and consent. For him to do what he did, there's also a period of the American people advise and consent.
Okay. Did he usurp his authority, Dara?
So the thing that gets me about the argument that this is unprecedented is I didn't hear a lot of that in 2012, and really the only difference between what happened in the deferred action program in 2012 and the one in 2014 is that the 2014 program was A, bigger, and B, there was slightly less public opinion consensus for parents of U.S. citizens should stay in the country, as opposed to, you know, children, people who came here as very young children. There was a lot of sympathy toward those cases, but there wasn't necessarily among, you know, most Americans for parents. That's, however, a political difference. It's not a legal one. So one of the things that was very frustrating to me on Monday was I didn't hear the Supreme Court actually grapple with what does it mean that this case is coming up now when a similar program in 2012 isn't even being challenged.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for being with us. We appreciate your time. Dara, thank you. Dara Lynn covers immigration and the justice system for Vox. Sam Baker, thanks to you as well. Sam is staff correspondent at National Journal and writes mostly about the U.S. Supreme Court and legal affairs. For those wondering when there will be a decision reached, it could happen Well, it's expected at the end of June. It could happen a little bit before that. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program. Thanks to Kendra Smith for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.